All right, Genesis chapter 6. Get your Bibles and let's go over to Genesis chapter 6 and we'll spend a little time in here. And as you turn over there, if you were to try to look at movies over the years, at popular books that have come out over the years, legends that have been told, there seems to be one common theme that kind of runs through a lot of those, kind of a recurring pattern, as it were. It seems like if you watch these movies, you read these books, you hear about these legends, and usually it's about this one individual who kind of rises up above everybody else. There seems to be a time of need, and this one individual rises up above everybody else. He has a moral fortitude that is unlike anybody else at that time, and it's something that's desperately needed. And so what ends up happening is he saves his family, he saves the city, you know, saves the world from this one guy. And you think about the movies that you've seen that fit that narrative. And why do so many movies fit that narrative? Because that's what people like. They want a hero movie. You know, they want a movie that shows, okay, here's this desperate situation, and oh, look over here, somebody rises up and saves the day. You know why that story resonates so well in the world today? Because it's based upon the ultimate story of that kind. Of a world that was in desperate need, and one came, rose up, and saved the day. And so, since Jesus came to this world and gave himself to in a sacrificial, selfless act to save mankind, guess what man's been telling? Stories like that. That's where a lot of our stories come from, is based upon that. Now, what's interesting is you go to the Bible, and are there other accounts, stories in the Bible about events that kind of have that same MO? Kind of have that same kind of narrative where you have this desperate, bleak situation and oh, is there any hope? But oh, look over here. Here's this Bible character who rises to greatness and does great things and saves the people. Well, does Noah fit that narrative? You know, you wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Noah. None of us would exist today if there wasn't a Noah and Mrs. Noah and a Shem and Mrs. Shem and a Ham and Mrs. Ham and a Japheth and Mrs. Japheth. We wouldn't be here. And yet they stood out different from everybody else that was around them. And so what I want us to do is I want us to talk about Noah tonight. And what we're doing, I mentioned this yesterday in the class we had yesterday. Everything in this VBS this year has been produced by Apologetics Press. And this is the first VBS that they have put out. They are planning to put out, I believe, about five of these. This is the materials. I haven't looked at everything that they have put, all of the materials, but at least some of the materials that I've looked at in this VBS kit is really one of the best I've ever seen. And we've used a lot for the last 20-something years. We've used a lot of materials, a lot of VBS materials from a couple different companies, and they do a very good job. But the content of this, the graphics that are involved in this are far above a lot of what other people are putting out. And so what we're doing in this class is we're taking what they gave for this lesson, and we're just going to follow right along with it. The PowerPoint is PowerPoint that they created. And so even for the adult classes, they created PowerPoint to be used in those classes. So I thought, well, you know, if they took the time to create it, we'll just follow along and use it. And so this it's going to look different than some of the typical PowerPoint that I might create. But I think it will be helpful for us. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at Noah. Yesterday, we looked at the world into which Noah came, and the world that was destroyed because of sin, and the world that Noah needed to save through his righteousness. Tonight we're looking at the man. This VBS material actually has five lessons in it. We're only looking at two of them, one yesterday, one tonight. The other three lessons that are in it are really lessons that Jeff Miller covered when he was here a couple weeks ago in our creation seminar. A lot of the material that's in these last three lessons he's already covered, so I don't want to repeat what he did. So we'll stick with this and just talk about the man tonight. But look in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 8. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 8, after God in these first seven verses of the chapter describes how horrible of a condition the world was in, how he had set out at that point with a determination to destroy the world because he was sorry, verse 6, that he had made man. What's the first word you have in Genesis 6 and verse 8? But. Do you see what's happening here? You've got this typical narrative that we are used to today where you start watching some film or some movie and it's just, oh, this is horrible. And it lays out the setting for you and it looks so bleak and what can happen. And then you get to verse 8, but. Oh, okay. There's something that's going to be different than the first seven verses that we've read. But Noah found what? Grace in the eyes of the Lord. What does that mean? What does it mean that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord? Say it again, Joe. He found favor. He found favor in the eyes of the Lord. What? Okay, he trusted in him. Here's the rest of the world going to be destroyed because of sin, but not Noah. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Why? Because God liked him. God liked him a little bit more than he liked everybody else. Is that what's? He's different. That's what we're going to talk about tonight is this man. This man who was different and his wife and his family. That was different than everybody else who lived in that day. And the point of this tonight is to say, what about me? What can make me different than everybody else that's around today? When you look at our nation today, when you look at our world today, have you had the thought, how much longer is God going to let this go on? Have you had that thought? I think most of you probably have. Why? Because you've read the Bible. Because you've read about the flood. You've read about Sodom and Gomorrah. You've read about the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom being carried off into captivity. And now you look at our world and you say, okay, what's going to happen to us? When sin has consequences all throughout the Bible, guess what happens today? Sin's got to have consequences. And so we look at that and say, there are consequences coming one of these days. What about me? Can I be the but David, the but Jerry, the but Kayla, that I'm not like those first seven verses of the world. I'm going to be different. I'm going to find grace in the eyes of the Lord. How do I do that? Number one is in verse 9. Verse 9 talks about Noah's perfection. Look at verse 9. This is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. What does it mean that Noah was perfect? Sometimes we hear the word perfect. We hear the word perfect and we think flawless, right? We think, you know, here is a person. If somebody's perfect, it just means that they've never done anything wrong. Is that what it means with Noah? Does it mean that he didn't do anything wrong? I mean, if you went into class one day, you took a test, and the next day you went in and the teacher said, you got a perfect score. She uses the word perfect. You got a perfect score on your test. What would that mean? No mistakes. Is that the way the word perfect is being used here? Noah made no mistakes. He was sinless. No wonder so if that's true, what would we say? Well, no wonder the Lord saved him. He didn't have any sins. So no wonder the Lord saved. Is that true about Noah? Was Noah a sinful person? We don't read a lot about that. We get into the latter part of chapter 9 and we read about a situation after the flood in which you see Noah who's drunk and exposed here at the end of the chapter. And you think, wow, you know what? this man's gone from greatness and now he's fallen down to this condition, and how could that happen? Well, does that mean he'd never sinned before chapter 9? What does Romans chapter 3 say? Does it say, does your Bible still say all have sinned and fallen short? Does your Bible still have that verse in it? Now, Romans chapter 3 only applies to New Testament people, right? From like Romans chapter 3 through current day, right? It doesn't go backwards. It only goes forward, right? No. Because when you get to Romans chapter 3, what chapter was before Romans chapter 3? You remember what chapter it was? Romans chapter 2. Good. Okay. Now, do you remember what chapter was before Romans chapter 2? Okay. So you all are good Bible students. You remember the chapters that come before. Okay. So Romans chapter 1, God tells the Gentiles, "You are full of sin. You have committed all of these sins against God." And the Jews are saying, "Get them, sick them. Yeah, all right, good." And then you get to Romans chapter 2. And what does God do? "Jews, excuse me, that'd be you. You're full of sin." Oh, man, us too? Gentiles, Jews, chapter 3. In case anybody feels like they were left out of chapter 1 or chapter 2, chapter 3, that'd be everybody else too. That applies to Adam and Eve and everybody on. So, when we read about Noah in chapter 6 being perfect, what does that mean? They've got this slide in here that they put that says, which of these circles is perfect? Now, we look at that, and if we take the flawless definition, if we take the definition that means there are no imperfections and no mistakes, you might point to one circle on the screen. But if you say to a child, "Draw me a circle," and they draw something that might look like the one on the left side or the right side of the screen, is that a circle on the right side of the screen? You'd be hard-pressed to say that's a triangle, wouldn't you? I mean, it doesn't really... A rectangle? No. You tell your child, "Draw me a circle," and they draw something that looks like the thing on the right side of the screen. Perfect. Good job. "No, that's not perfect." Yes. Is it a circle? Then it's perfect. Not flawless. Not all of the angles and the degrees are right, but perfect in the way that God defines. And the way that God defines perfect generally in Scripture is to talk about us being mature, being complete. Not that we haven't made any mistakes. Some of us think we've got to be this kind of Christian without anything wrong with us. How's that going to work out for us? We're not going to be that. Now, does that mean we don't strive? Does that mean we don't strive to not sin? It's interesting. It's interesting when you read 1 John chapter 1. Read 1 John chapter 1, and every other verse at the end of 1 John chapter 1 says, if you say you haven't sinned, you just sinned. Bad paraphrase. But if you say you have no sin, you lie and you don't practice the truth. And so you've got in verse 6, verse 8, and verse 10 of that chapter saying, everybody has sinned. But then if you ignore the chapter division between chapter 1 and chapter 2, you get to chapter 2, and John says, now I'm writing these things to you so that you may not sin. Oh, wait a minute. You just said, if we haven't sinned, then, of course we're going to sin. But I'm writing this so that you may not sin. What's God's desire for us? God's desire for us is that we don't sin. Will God still take us if our circle looks like this? Yep. Because if that's the best we can do, He's going to take it every day. Now, back to Noah. We got off track there. Back to Noah. What do we know about Noah? Was he absolutely flawless? Was he absolutely sinless? And this verse in James chapter 1 uses that terminology about us, about being perfect and complete and lacking nothing. No, Noah was not flawless. He was not sinless, as we might think about that word perfect being used. But the way the word perfect is being used here is to talk about someone as being someone who has a maturity and not a flawlessness. Would you say that you have a perfect car? Would you say your car is perfect? How many of you rode in a car to get here tonight? Just out of curiosity. How many of you rode in a car to get here tonight? Okay. Those of you who have your hands raised, say you rode in a car to get here tonight, you have a perfect car. You know why? It did its job. What's a car supposed to do? Is a car supposed to play tunes for you? Is it supposed to hook into your Bluetooth as soon as you pop in the car? Is that what a car is supposed to do? Well, yeah, that's what we paid the big bucks for. Is your car supposed to cool you with the air coming at your face as well as cool you? If those of you have those cool cars that cool your other side when you're sitting in the seat and you got those cool seats, literally. Is that what your car is supposed to do? Well, that's, of course that's what it's supposed to do. I paid the big bucks for that. What's your car supposed to do? It's supposed to get you where you're going. So your car may not have the cool seats, and it may not have the radio that clicks into your phone as soon as you get in there, and the AC may not work, and it may be one of those cars. Do you have one of those cars where the crank doesn't work anymore? That you fixed it once and it worked for a while and then it got broken again. And so you just said, all right, we'll just leave it in the up position and we won't touch it. Guess what? Your car is perfect. And you say, yes, put the vice grips on it. Done that before. Your car is perfect. No, it's not. It's janky. No, your car is perfect. Why? Because it's doing what it was designed to do. What about us? Can we have some flaws? Can we have some things that we're working on? Can we have those cranks that we keep not working right, but we still go back and try to fix it the way it's supposed to be? Don't misunderstand. There's nothing in this that says that sin is okay. But every part of this is to say that when we look at Noah, God took a man that the Bible describes as being perfect, not flawless, but somebody who had created about his life a maturity in order to be used. The reason, and it says here's two reasons we need to know this. Number one, this is their slide, an interesting graphic, right? Number one reason we need to realize that Noah was not flawless, but he was mature, was so that we don't distance ourselves from Noah. Meaning, so that we don't say, yeah, of course God used him. Look at Noah. I can't be Noah. Noah was perfect. Noah never did anything wrong. And so, of course, God could use somebody like him. But God can't use somebody like me. If we get out of our heads that definition of what it means to be perfect and think about Noah as being mature and complete. Tell me some qualities about Noah that you would think would make him mature and complete. Not flawless. He had integrity. He was a good leader. Did he do anything for his family? Did he raise his family in the right direction? Did he train up his children the way they should go? Did his children ever make mistakes? Just shake your head this way. You know, does the Bible tell us? No. But life tells us his kids made mistakes. What else about Noah? Think things that we don't know because of the text, but things that we would assume about a man like Noah. Say it again. He lived off the land. What'd you say, Allison? Must have had a good heart. He's a hard worker. Ready for the challenge. He's not flawless, but are there qualities about Noah that we need to have? Being a stand-up individual. Do you think Noah was a stand-up individual? Someone who trusted in God. Was Noah somebody who trusted in God? Are there qualities that we know that Noah must have had in order to fulfill the commands that God gave to him? Do you think that Noah looked for opportunities to teach others about God? Do we look for opportunities to teach others about God? Do you suppose that Noah was a man who prayed? I suppose he was. Can we be a person who prays? We don't need to distance ourselves from Noah. Oh, of course God used him. He was perfect. He was a mature follower of God who put his desire to follow God above everything else. The second thing, second reason, and it kind of just goes right in with that first one, is that we don't need to distance ourselves from Noah. We don't need to say, oh, he was flawless. No, he was mature. so that we can make ourselves available. If God could use Noah, can He use me? It's not going to happen, okay? But what if, in the midst of all that's going on in our world, God came to you and said, I need you. I need you to come and to do this and do this and do this. Otherwise, this world is completely lost. Could I be that person that He would come to? Again, that's not in that direct avenue, that direct communication is not going to happen. But in this communication, has it happened? Can I be someone that God can count on? Not perfect, not flawless. The Bible describes Noah as a preacher of righteousness. You suppose he fought against the evil of his day? Don't you think he tried? Don't you think he stood up to the peer pressure? Do you think his peers tried to put pressure on him? Yeah. As far as we know, it may not have rained before this time. But here's a man who educated his family and did all that he could to be a strong follower of God. Suppose, you know, you're reading through Genesis chapter 6 and how horrible this is. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And Noah, here's the genealogy of Noah in verse 9. And he was perfect and he walked with God. Suppose God was good. If God was going to recount again the history of the world, could He call out us by name? I mean, could He call one of us out? Not saying we're perfect, but to say, but Scott found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Scott was a man who owned his own business and used his business to help others and tried to use it to benefit those even in the church. He raised a godly family, married to a godly wife. Does that mean that Scott's perfect? Flawless? Perfect? No.
I think
he listened to the elders. But is Scott mature? I mean, could God write that kind of sentence about one of us? He's writing it about Noah. Not because he didn't make any mistakes in his life, but because there was something different about this man than everybody else in the world. What made that difference? Noah was obedient to God. Do I ask? Anybody ever gone to basic training? I've never had the pleasure. Anybody ever gone to basic training? Vince? Scott? Gone to basic training? Yolanda? Is that a fun, would you say that's a fun experience? Would you say, you know, that's just the best thing that's ever happened? Maybe you would. Basic training is one of those times where an individual is reshaped, reformed, where an individual, I want you to think about what happens in basic training. An individual goes into basic training and they are told to do things, commanded to do things in such a way that is anything less than perfection, is anything less than doing what they are told, is anything less than that acceptable? I mean, think about you go to basic training and you got to shine your boots. Who cares about your stinking boots? I mean, the boots are going to, your boots are the closest thing down to the ground and the dirt that there's going to be. They're going to get dirty. In fact, on some job sites today, if your boots aren't dirty, you're looked at like you're some kind of a novice. You're like, oh, that's cute. You have new boots on. Your boots are so pretty. And so it's like a mark of I've arrived when you've got the dirty boots at the workplace, right? And so here you go into the military. What's the big deal? So you're told, shine the boots. You're told to make your bed. Tell me, what do shiny boots have to do with being successful in wartime? What does being able to make your bed, What does that have to do with being a successful soldier and being successful when it comes time to go to battle? Just little insignificant things. But what do? They train you. Before he wants to take you into battle where stuff is real, he wants to know, will you listen to what I'm saying? Will you say, yes, sir, to the authority? Is that enough just to listen and to say, yes, sir? Number three, will you go and do what you've been told to do? Is that what basic training is about? Listen, yes, sir, to the authority. Acknowledge you are the authority and I am not. And then going and doing what you've been told to do. Now, basic training lasts how long? 6 weeks? 8 weeks? How long was Noah's basic training? A little bit long. I mean, if you take the entirety of it, you've got 100 years. How would you like 100? And I'm not trying to totally compare 6 or 8 weeks of basic training today to Noah's 100 years of preparing the ark. But how would you like to be involved in that for 100 years? How would you like to be involved in anything for 100 years? But how would you like to be involved in that for 100 years? Look in Genesis chapter 6. Go down to the end of the chapter. I think it's the last verse. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 22. Thus Noah did. God gives him all of these commands about the ark, gives him what he wants him to do in order to prepare the ark, gives him even the commands in verse 21 about the food that's going to have to be gathered for the ark. And then verse 22 says, thus Noah did. According to what? All that God commanded him, so he did. Look in chapter 7 and verse 5. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. What do we see about Noah? Noah listened. Noah acknowledged. Who's the authority in this situation? Not Noah. Yes, Lord. And he did exactly what the Lord told him to do. That kind of obedience, to God's instructions, does that cost a person anything? I want you to think about that. The AP guys came up with three things to think about when we think about Noah's obedience training and what it cost Noah to obey God the way that he did. Sees that Noah's obedience was physically demanding. Would you say that was true? We don't know if he was or not, but in your mind, was Noah a lumberjack before God said, build an ark? We don't know, okay? But in our minds, you know, he's just not. Maybe he was, and maybe that's why God told him to build the ark, because he was the best lumberjack on earth. But in our minds, he wasn't. But let me ask you this question. Did he need to be? Did he need to be the best lumberjack on earth in order for God to say, that's my guy? That's the one who's going to build an ark? No. But how labor intensive was it to build an ark? We look at it and say, wow, he had 100 years to do it. How long would it take you? Honestly, how long would it take me? I would need more than 100 years. I mean, I don't even know what's involved, but 100 years, when God says build an ark, I'm going to need a little bit of time on this one. So here's Noah, physically demanding. How many hours a day do you suppose Noah worked on building an ark? You think he kind of slept in most days? You know, kind of a lazy morning. Honey, is the breakfast ready? Oh, no, not ready. Okay, I'm going to go back to sleep for a little bit. And then, you know, just let me know when breakfast. You think he had a lazy morning? Is that the picture of Noah that you've got? How many days a week do you suppose he worked? You think there was anything else going on in Noah's mind other than, I've got to build an ark? Now, how long was the ark? 300 cubits, right? 450 feet long. How wide was the ark? Good, 50 cubits. Y'all are on target tonight. 75 feet wide. How tall was the ark? 30 cubits. 30 cubits, that's right. So 30 cubits. So we've got 45, 75, 450. How many gopher wood trees is that going to take? Now, of course, in my mind, I'm just thinking about the outside. Any wood needed inside? Three levels? Are you going to divide the sheep from the goats inside the ark? Recommended. Are you going to divide the animals from each other? How much gopher wood? I mean, just start running in your mind. How many trees of gopher wood is this going to require? Now, when was the last time you, without your power tools, went and cut down a tree, went and whacked off all of the branches of that tree, went and planed the surface of that tree to get it down to a smooth and usable surface, and then moved that now piece of wood into place and set it into place so that you could go and start over with the next tree? You ever done that? How many times do you have to do that to build an ark? How many trees? How far does he have to travel? I mean, in my mind, God says gopher wood because he is surrounded by gopher wood. I don't think God said use gopher wood because he's going to have to travel to Australia to get it and he's testing his faith. That's not my picture. I picture God saying use gopher wood and Noah's like, yes, gopher wood, because that's right here. Okay, but how far do you have to go? I mean, even if the closest trees supply you early on, how much do you have to have? How many animals do you need to haul and move those trees? You want to train those animals, or you want to take them to a training school to get them trained? You think about how labor intensive this was for Noah, and I recognize that that he had help in this, and we'll talk about that as we go through this. Now, he gets the wood up there. What's going to keep this wood from leaking? I mean, wouldn't that be important? Don't you figure Mrs. Noah was like, when we get in this thing, we're not going to have any leaks, are we, honey? Come on, tell me. So, I mean, if you're going to put your whole family in this, if you're going to put the parents of your future grandchildren inside of this vessel, do you want any leaks in it? No. So what do you have to make sure there's no leaks? What did God tell them to use? Pitch. What's that? You wind up, get ready, check the man on base. What's pitch? Like tar. Where was he supposed to put the pitch? Inside and outside. Are you getting the picture here about how labor, not just all of the lumber that was going to be needed, but how about this pitch? Have you ever created tar? Have you ever created pitch? How much would be needed? 150, 75, 45, outside, inside. How much is going to be needed? Not only to find the source of it, read about how pitch is made, not only to find where the source of it's going to be, but to be able to, you've got to be able to heat it up, don't you? I mean, you've got to be able to spread this stuff inside and out. You've got to be able to have some kind of, when you drive by, when they're paving the streets, is that stuff hot? Yeah. You can feel it when you drive by. They've got to find the source for it. They've got to be able to heat it. They've got to be able to get it to where they need and to spread it inside and out. How long do you need to build an ark now? Now that you're starting to think through the whole process, is 100 years enough? This is a physically demanding thing that God called upon him to do. And then we saw in verse 21, it's not just about building the ark. Are you going to need food? Are the animals going to need food? How are you? It's not just, I don't know, how often do you make a grocery run? I mean, do you make a grocery run once a week? Every other week? Some people make a grocery run every day. Whatever floats your boat. Isn't that kind of interesting to talk about with Noah? Whatever floats, but how often were they going to be able to make a grocery run? Now, there are some who conjecture that maybe they were growing some of their food even inside the ark with them. And that would have been it. But you still have to plan for that, don't you? You still got to get... So, labor intensive. When you think about Noah and his obedience to God, is our obedience anything like his? Is our obedience as physically exhausting as his was? Or should it be? Physically demanding. Number two, his obedience was mentally challenging. I'm not saying that Noah had mental problems. I'm saying that it was mentally challenging. When you read Genesis chapter 6, we don't know this, so you don't have to answer. You read Genesis chapter 6, do you think God gave Noah any other instructions than these about the ark? We don't know. What if he didn't? What if what we have in Genesis chapter 6 are, when you talk about a blueprint, Dan, when you talk about a blueprint for the ark, what kind of blueprint did God give Noah for the ark? Bare bones. If Genesis chapter 6 is all we got, I mean, it's bare, you've got the length, you got the width, you got the height, you got the material, you got the levels, you've got, but how many decisions is Noah going to have to make in the process of building this ark? Hundreds? Thousands? I mean, how many calculations? How many calculations is he going to have to make? You know, was Noah a good student in mathematics? I hope so. Did Noah take physics when he went to school? Did he graduate with an engineering degree? I mean, does he need all of those skills in order to build? It's not just physically demanding. It is mentally challenging. It's going to require a great deal of mental acuity in order to do this. So God says, Noah, build an ark. Okay, God, when do I start? When do I start? Not just when do I start, where do I start? Where would you start in building an ark? I know where I'd start. I'd start praying. I'd be praying my guts out. Okay, God, this is going to be fun. I mean, he's got to think, where do I start? Was that a hand or just a little light of mine shining?
His response may have been what Bill Cosby suggested. What's an ark?
What's an ark? Yeah, that's true. That great bit, Noah built an ark. Great, Lord, what's an ark? 75 feet. How are you going to get up there? You think Noah had ever seen scaffolding before? Noah invented scaffolding. I mean, how are you going to get up there? Can you imagine raising your son? Son, get up there. I'm afraid of heights. I'm 500 something years old. I'm afraid of heights. Get up there. And I mean, he's got to figure out how to do all of this. What do you think that Noah had all of the tools that he needed? Or do you think he invented some of the tools that we have today in order to build this kind of an ark? Do you think that how is he going to keep his measurements consistent? I mean, 300 cubits long, what's a cubit? Well, cubits from here to here. Well, do you think his cubit was the same as Ham's cubit? They might have had different cubits. How do you keep your measurements consistent? Well, obviously, I don't think they were using their, you know, they hopefully they would have created some kind of a measuring rod, but you got to keep it consistent. Because when you say, go out and cut me, go cut 100 logs that are 50 feet long, well, how long do you need all those logs to be? You need them all the same length. Otherwise, you're in a big heap of trouble. He's got all of these things to think about. You know, how are you going to attach them together? When Ham puts it up there, how are you going to keep it from falling down before Shem comes and puts the next one? I mean, you got to figure out all of the ingenuity of putting all of this together. And so, obviously, God was the chief engineer in all of this. Obviously, God is the one who is ultimately in charge of everything that's involved in building this ark. But not only do I think Noah was the muscle in this project, he's the brains in this too, isn't he? God says, Noah, build an ark. You think Noah had any idea what he was getting into? God wants us to become a Christian. Do we know everything that we're getting into when we become a Christian? No. Does it matter? You think after 45 years, Noah's like, whew, wow, this is taking a little bit longer than I thought it was. Don't volunteer an answer to this. Husbands, have you ever started a project and your wife asked you, when are you going to finish that? Can you imagine Mrs. Noah? Honey, when are you going to finish that? I need a few more years, babe. 100 would be nice. The muscle and the brains. So here's a job. His obedience, physically demanding, mentally challenging. What about emotionally taxing? What about his neighbors? We don't know, but we can guess, can't we? What about his neighbors? Hey, Noah, what you doing? Building an ark? The Cosby line? What's an ark, Noah? Noah's not only doing this, he is a preacher of righteousness trying to get these people to repent. And he tells them that he's building a boat that's 450 feet long, made out of only gopher wood. And he's doing this because there's going to be a flood that is going to come. It's going to wipe out the earth. And what are your friends going to say to you? Oh, really? Uh-huh. Right. Have you been down to that nice little room they have down at that particular hospital over there and had yourself checked out recently, Noah? Because, no, something's not right with you. Can you imagine what people said to him? If people had the audacity to walk by the Son of God and wag their heads at him, saying, oh, if he's the Son of God, let him come down, and they spit in his face, what would they do to a nobody like Noah? Can you imagine what he put up with? Can you imagine what his sons put up with? Oh, you go to school. You go to school and the attendance is called. I'm Ham Noah. Noah's your dad. Your dad's the one building. Oh, it's bless your heart. Can you imagine? That's your dad growing up. Emotionally taxing? Do you think that weighed on him at any point? Was there anybody else in the world building an ark? You ever feel like you're the only one trying to do what's right? I'm the only one, Lord. Did Elijah ever think that? I'm the only one? And he wasn't. But was Noah the only one? He really was. He really was the only one. And yet, can you imagine what he had to put up with from these individuals on a regular basis, as no doubt he dealt with great ridicule in the midst of what he was doing? Do you suppose that it is going to become easier for us or harder for us to live faithful Christian lives? Meaning, do you suppose that as the years progress from here onward, that people are going to let up on us for living the Christian life, or are going to dig in even more? Which would you suppose, based upon current trends? You think Noah decided to cut some corners in his project? I don't think Noah cut any corners. One, because God, the chief engineer, is watching over his shoulder the whole time. Two, because Mrs. Noah, the second chief engineer, was watching over his shoulder the whole time. He's not going to put his wife and his family in jeopardy. He's not going to cut any corners. He's not going to slack up on what God wants him to do. He's going to do all that he can to do what God asked him to do. Do you suppose that any doubts ever creeped into his mind? Had he ever seen a flood before? Nope. Had he ever seen enough water before to lift a 450-foot-long ark off of the ground? I don't think so. Do you think he had any doubts to ever creep into his mind? He kept on keeping on. Why? Because he trusted God. Soldiers go into the battlefield. Do they have doubts coming to their minds about what they're being told to do? Or did the shine your boots, the make your bed, the little things that they were told to do and they listened? Yes, sir, I will do that. And they followed. Was that training them so that when it came to the big things, they said, yes, sir, I'll go and do that? Are there some little things in the Christian life that we look at and say, yep, no problem, I'll do that. And then we face some big things like, oh, that's a little harder. Interestingly, they listed four things in this AP lesson for Christians. Four things that might challenge us as Christians. Number one is giving joyfully. Is there a difference between giving and giving joyfully? Can you give sacrificially but not give joyfully? Notice this word "and" up here. Could you give generously but not give joyfully? Could you give joyfully but not give generously? Lord, you can have this 50 cents. I will be so happy to give you this 50 cents because I can't stand having loose change in my pocket. It's all yours, Lord, and I've got it with a happy smile on my face. Giving sacrificially and joyously at the same time. Is that a challenge sometimes? Or is that a challenge that we overcome and we say, Lord, I want to give this to you. I'm happy to give this to you. What about withdrawing fellowship? Is that a hard thing to do sometimes? It's a hard thing to do every time. But because it's a hard thing to do, does that mean, well, that's just kind of tough. I don't think I'm going to do that. Imagine if Noah kind of backed away from the hard things in building the ark. Well, I don't know about that, God. That's going to prolong this project another 20 years, God. What if he backed away from the hard things? God tells us to do something for a reason, for the betterment of the church, and not just for the betterment of the church, for the betterment, for the best, seeking what's best for the individual from whom fellowship is being withdrawn. Hard thing, but it's a necessary thing. What about keeping our language pure? We live in a world, is that easy to do? Keeping our language pure? I mean, you can't even watch television today. I don't know if this is true, but we have come to the unscientific conclusion that every movie on Netflix is rated R. I know that's not true. I know there's some things that are not. But, I mean, it just seems like everything we look at on Netflix is a rated R, and we won't watch it. It's not because we're not old enough. I think we're old enough to watch a rated R movie unless they've changed the age range on that recently. But when I fill my heart with those kind of things, guess what wants to come out of my heart? Do you have people in your life that can't keep their language pure? Do we struggle with that? That's just a worldly struggle, right? Once you become a Christian, you don't have struggles with your language anymore, right? It's as pure and as clean and as beautiful as can be, right? Because you became a Christian. You got baptized and no more language problems, right? Wouldn't that be nice? Not the case. Takes struggle. Takes effort on our part. What about spreading the gospel? Does that take effort on our part? Some people look at Noah and say he was a failure as a preacher. We talked about this yesterday. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5 describes him as a preacher of righteousness. And some people look at him and say, boy, what a failure. You know, he had 100 years to preach and all he converted was his own family. Guess what? That's not a failure. Train up a child in the way he should go. And when you do that, does that mean you're a failure? Some congregations, and well, I'll be more specific. Some preachers. Preachers talk. You know, sometimes we go to lectureships and we talk about how things going. That's kind of the question preachers ask each other. How's things going? Well, we haven't had many baptisms lately, somebody will say. And then sometimes the next statement will be, and the only baptisms we had are our own kids. What does that mean? Those don't count. That's not what they mean. That's not what they mean. But it's what we say. What do they mean by that? What they mean is, we are not reaching out like we should to the world and bringing in the lost to be saved, and the only ones that are being baptized are the ones that we are raising. Is that a failure? Oh, dear God, let us never say that's a failure. Not, well, the only ones that are being baptized are our kids. Thanks be to God that they are. Do we have a responsibility towards our children? Yes. Do we have a responsibility towards the world? Yes, we certainly do. And so here's Noah, and we're reading about Noah and his maturity, his perfection, his maturity. The reason that he was used by God is that he had developed himself to be able to be used by God. We've looked at Noah and his obedience, but we've just got a few minutes. Let's talk about Noah's faith. What kind of faith did Noah have? Would you say it was a strong faith? Yeah. Strong enough faith that when God comes to him and says, build an ark, what does Noah go out and do? He builds an ark. Some people today have the idea that faith is just a warm, fuzzy feeling that you get in your heart. And the way they define faith is that you get this warm, fuzzy feeling, you kind of feel good because you can't really base it upon solid evidence. So you just have a warm, fuzzy, just a confident feeling that this has got to be what it is. And you say, that's not the definition of faith. Well, look, if you were to look in dictionaries, if you were to look up the word faith in dictionaries, guess how it's defined in English. Guess how faith is defined. A firm belief in something for which there is no proof. That's how the world talks about faith. You just kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling. I kind of feel good about this, but you have no proof for it. So when they look at you as a Christian, what do they believe about your faith? You have no proof. Another definition says faith is belief that does not rest on logical or material evidence. So you have faith, but there's no logical reason for you to have faith. There's no logical evidence, there's no material evidence for your faith. That's what the world believes about you and your faith in God. Is that the kind of faith that Noah had? Was Noah's faith a faith that had no proof? Had he ever seen an ark? I doubt it. Had he ever seen a global flood? We know he hadn't seen that. And yet God says, build an ark because I'm going to flood the earth. Right, God. Okay, we're going to do this. Was his faith based upon perceptible, what people would think of as perceptible evidence at that point? Well, maybe not. But was Noah able to see the earth that he was living on? Yeah. Noah was able to see the earth that he was living on. And I only have a couple minutes. This is Dick Staniel, who wrote a book for AP called Faith and Reason. He says there is not a single item in Christianity, think about this, not a single item in Christianity upon which our soul's salvation depends that is only probably true. What does that mean? If you take out all of these negatives, there's not a single thing in Christianity that is based upon only probable evidence. What does that mean if you take out the negative and make it a positive? Your faith is based upon solid evidence, not just probably true. In each case, the evidence supplied is sufficient to establish conclusive proof regarding the truth of the Christian faith. And so we understand faith to be based upon evidence. Was Noah's faith based upon evidence? What does Romans chapter 1 say? Since the creation. Did Noah live since the creation? Yep. Since the creation, God's invisible attributes. What does the word invisible mean? Can't see it. God's invisible attributes. Which one of God's invisible attributes can you see? Well, they're invisible. But since creation, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen. You Christians are awfully silly. You can see the invisible. Bless your heart. Pat you on the head. You've just got a tender soul. Can you really see the invisible attributes of God? Yes. What does the rest of the verse say? Being understood by the things that are made. Can you see the things that are made? Yep. I can see the things that are made. And when I can see the things that are made, what do I know? There is an eternal power and there is an eternal Godhead. How do I know that? By opening my eyes. When God comes to Noah and says, build an ark, does Noah have any perceptible evidence, proof upon which to base his faith? Yep. He has, number one, the world around him that proves there is a God. Number two, he has a verbal message from his God that just spoke to him. Don't you wish we had those same things? Don't you wish our faith could be as strong as Noah's faith and have those same two evidences? Do we have the same two evidences? We have the world around us, and we have a verbal message from God that has absolute evidence within it to prove that it is from God. Noah had never seen a flood. Doesn't matter. There's going to be a flood. You know why? Because my God, who made everything that I see, told me that it's going to happen. Have you ever seen heaven? Anybody ever seen heaven? Seen pictures, right? Ever seen heaven? How do you know it's there? I know heaven is there for the same reason that Noah knew that the flood was coming. Because I see what God has made, and I know that God is going to be true to His word. Do you know that this world is going to end? Noah knew his world was going to end. How did he know it was going to end? God told him. Is our world going to end? Yep, not with a flood, but with fire, and everything's going to be burned. Why do you believe that? Because I believe what I see, and I believe the one who made the things that I see. And so when he says to me, let not your heart be troubled, you believe in God, believe also in me, in my Father's house, there's lots of dwelling places. Come and live there with me. Well, how do you know that's there? Because the one who made it told me it's there. Our faith is not some silly, bless your heart, you don't have any evidence for it. Quite the opposite. Those who have a faith in something that where there is no evidence and bless their hearts for believing in something where there is no solid proof for it are those who believe in Darwinian evolution. There is no evidence for that. And yet that's taught as fact today. What do we need to do? We need to believe what God says. We need to have the kind of faith that Noah had. Noah's faith believed what God said, and Noah's faith acted upon what God said. That's what faith is. That's what biblical faith is. Believe the words and then act upon the words. And so in 2 Peter chapter 3, God says, the day of the Lord is coming in which the world is going to be destroyed. What do we need to do? We need to live in holy conduct and godly lives. That's what we've got to do. That's what Noah did to get himself ready. I think our time is up. The children are gathering in the lobby. They're going to come in here. I think we're going to sing a couple more songs and then wrap things up. Thank you all very much for your good attention tonight. Bobo, if you want to come on up, I know Tyler's got the first group of kids out there, and we're going to start letting them come in.